CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Hello and welcome to City Talk's Business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the Independent Private Sector Lobby Group and Business Networking Club Downtown Liverpool and Business. And every Sunday, we look at some of the week's big business stories and talk to some key personalities, decision makers and entrepreneurs who work in and influence Liverpool and the wider Northwest region. This week, we're talking the Liverpool Plan, cruise liner terminals and the Global Entrepreneurs Congress. We'll also be looking at the skills, education and training agenda in the city, and I'll be asking why people in the public sector believe that it's their God-given right to be ring-fenced and protected from the recession, unlike the rest of us, at least as far as their pensions are concerned. To discuss and maybe even debate this with me today, I'm joined in the studio by Liverpool City Council Cabinet Member Nick Small, Natalie Haywood from the fabulous Leaf on Bold Street, Michael Taylor, who's the editor of eminent business publication Insider magazine, and on the phone, I'm delighted this morning to have the president of Cunard Cruises, Peter Shanks, who I'm going to talk to first. Peter, good morning to you.
Good morning, Frank.
Delighted that you've been able to join us today, as I say. Just want to find out what Cunard's view is of Liverpool's bid for a cruise liner terminal. I know that you'll be aware of the debate that's been taking place in this city and beyond. So what are your thoughts on that issue?
Well, Cunard, of course, we enjoy a wonderful relationship with the City of Liverpool, with our old, beautiful building, one of the Three Graces, and we really enjoy coming up to Liverpool with our ships. In fact, this coming September, the Queen Elizabeth, our new ship, will be making her maiden call on Thursday the 8th of September. And then just a week later, Queen Mary 2 will be in the city. So to have two of our liners in will be terrific. And in fact, the city is to be congratulated on the cruise terminal that they built a few years ago, because that allows us to come right into the heart of the city. Of course, the big debate is the little terminal they've built is fine for visiting cruise ships. But I think when you start to look at the facilities you require for what we call a full turnaround, i.e. the ability to disembark 2,500 people and embark 2,500 people on a new voyage, that's a totally different kettle of fish, and I think that's what the debate is about.
And just give us some sense of what that sort of facility, that turnaround facility that you refer to there, what kind of difference could that potentially make for Liverpool?
Well, it's a bit catch-22 in a way that it's really up to the city to decide what sort of investment they want to make. But clearly, if they had the ability for different cruise lines to advertise and start cruises out of Liverpool, either going up north to the fjords or going all the way down to the Mediterranean, then that clearly would be a big draw to the city. And I think there are an awful lot of people who would love to cruise from Liverpool. It's a big investment, however, because you've got to build a significant infrastructure in terms of roads, in terms of the terminal itself. And, of course, it's not just about moving people around. It's also about all the logistics and the trucks and the provisions, etc. So it's a big investment. And I think the most important thing is the city need to be sure that they can get sufficient cruise lines to start a cruise in Liverpool, because it's not closer to the Mediterranean than Southampton, so that's a challenge, if I'm honest. So if people were going from Liverpool on the ship down to the Mediterranean, then it's an extra day cruising down the coast of England and an extra day cruising back up the coast of England. So that means less time in the Mediterranean and more cost. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, going north, then it might be quite attractive. Of course, our history is New York, and Liverpool's a good place to kick off to New York.
Yeah, and I think what the city leaders would argue, and I think, you know, what I would say to you, Peter, is there is an absolute commitment from the administration at the town hall that this will be built, and the money and the necessary infrastructure works that you refer to there will take place. But, you know, Liverpool has become, over the past decade or so, a destination city, somewhere where visitor numbers have increased significantly, and a place where people do actually come to visit to see the great city that we have, not just historically, but the modern Liverpool now. And so I think the people will probably be sceptical about not being able to take on Southampton, even given the geographical arguments that you've just put up there.
Well, we're very careful to stay out of anything that might be seen to be political, and we've been based in Liverpool in the past. We're now based in Southampton. But I think you make a really good point about how could the city benefit, because if you take that the investment that was made in the Little Cruz terminal was a very wise one, because this year, for example, not only are we bringing in the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth, but our sister company, Princess, are bringing in one of their very large ships. And in fact, in terms of the contribution to the local community, the local tourist areas, bringing 2,000 to 3,000 people into the city for a day can generate an awful lot of revenue and goodwill for the city. Whereas if you're a terminal where people are departing, you know, someone might set off from Manchester, drive to Liverpool, park their car, get on a ship and go somewhere, come back, get in their car and go home. Now, Liverpool attractions and the city of Liverpool may benefit from that less than they would from what they're doing currently. So I wouldn't decry the efforts that have been made so far, because that gives our people a great experience. And we bring many Americans, and they just love to go to the Cavern and do all those wonderful things in Liverpool. So I think Liverpool's already made a very wise investment. We're in quite a good place. But we're always careful. It's a bit chicken and egg. You know, we would wait for someone to develop facilities before deciding whether to go there. It doesn't work the other way around.
Yeah, in terms of whether there is a need in terms of the market, I suppose, is what you're saying, yeah?
Yes, because I think some other cruise lines, I think either was it Fred Olsen or Thomson Cruises, they've sort of been in and out. So that I know they had to do their turnaround somewhere else in the docks, but that experiment didn't necessarily prove that Liverpool would be a good kicking-off point for a cruise. Whereas what we're doing at the moment, bringing our ships in for the day, is fantastic for the city, because, you know, not only is it great for people to see our liners in the city, but it brings great revenue to many people who have little businesses in Liverpool, which is really important.
Let me move away from Liverpool for a moment, Peter, and talk about this latest holiday trend, which I have to say I've only learnt about this week when I found out that you were coming on to the station to talk to me about it. But it's multi-cations cruises. Now, can you explain what that actually is, what it means, and why it's the latest holiday trend?
Yeah, I'm not sure all these clever names. Last year, people were talking about staycations. You don't go away, and it's always dangerous to stay at home because it always rains. But I think multi-cation might be getting to the root of the fact that these days, lots of people are becoming much more adventurous in their holidays. So, you know, in the old days, we'd all go off on a package holiday to Mallorca and we'd stay in the one hotel and we'd really enjoy it. Now people are branching out and saying, do you know what, I want to go to different places. And I think that's part of the success of cruise, because you might go on a ship for 2 weeks, but you'll visit 8 to 10 different places. And people are becoming much more adventurous in their holiday choices. And I think multi-cation, not that I like that sort of word, maybe describes the fact that people are becoming more adventurous. They're seeing incredible value for money. And cruising is filling that slot. And so is, you know, things like going to Orlando in Florida and doing your own thing and seeing different theme parks and trying a bit on the beach and then going to the parks. People are becoming much more adventurous in their holiday choices.
Do you think that the image of cruisers being for, how can I put this in a political correct term, for the older generation, do you think that it's managing to lose that type of image? Because certainly from my perspective, I'm not going to tell you how old I am, but I still have this sense that if I was to go onto a cruise, you know, I'm going to be tripping over Zimmer frames and walking past people. You know, it's that sort of image that I have in my mind. Have cruise liners modernised? Have the holidays that you organise now modernised sufficiently to interest the younger generation?
Oh, I think so. And by the way, you're not alone. A lot of people still have those views of the cruise sector, and all the cruise lines work hard to overcome that, and it's beginning to happen. If you look at some broad numbers, there's about 1.6 million people will go on a cruise this year. And that's now reached about 10% of the size of the package holiday market. So that's quite big. And of course, cruise has been growing and growing, whereas the traditional holiday market has been declining. If you look at the hardware, the physical ships that we're all building, whether it's the new Cunard ships, the big new P&O ships, or brands like Royal Caribbean or the big American cruise companies, the facilities on board those ships these days are fantastic. I mean, yes, of course, we all have the large dining rooms, but we have a real range of smaller restaurants. So it's a bit like being able to go out to different restaurants every evening. The children's facilities are incredibly modern with all the latest Xboxes and games for the kids. The theatres are incredibly modern. For example, we're offering on Queen Mary 2, we've just launched 3D cinema.
Yeah.
And so you can go and watch Toy Story 3, you can watch a full version of Carmen and the new Pirates of the Caribbean film. And, you know, that's a really modern thing to do. But you're absolutely right that people are still a little bit frightened of cruising, but I think the value for money is beginning to persuade people that, gosh, do you know what? You get everything pretty much included in the price, and it's great quality. But we always work hard to tell people that younger people can go, families can go. But it is true to say that our core market is still the elder customer, because they're wonderful for us because they have more time in their hands, and they like to go for cruising quite frequently. But no, we should invite you down and see one of our ships, because most people who haven't seen a modern cruise liner is amazed when they see the quality of it.
I'd be delighted to take you up on your offer, and even more delighted to come on a cruise, Peter, if you start sailing from Liverpool. But thanks for joining us this morning. It's been great to speak to you.
We hope to give something to the city up in September. We'll be doing our regular fireworks and creating some of that Cunard magic in the Mersey, and it's a highlight of our year coming to Liverpool, that's for sure.
Fantastic. Well, thanks very much. The president of Cunard Cruises, Peter Shanks. Well, Nick, that was, I think, a fairly reasonable and objective view of the cruise liner campaign that we've got in our city. But what would you say to people like Peter who suggest that maybe Southampton is just geographically a much better location to start sailing cruises
from? I think the clear point that he made was that the cruise market is a growing market, and what we want in Liverpool is a bigger slice of a growing pie. I think, you know, Liverpool's really ambitious around this. The way we've repositioned the city around the visitor economy brought more tourists into Liverpool over the past few years. I think it shows the ambition that we have around this. But, you know, it's about playing to Liverpool's strengths. We are one of the world's most iconic ports. I think that's really important to bring cruise liners back to Liverpool. You know, and I think we've got a unique offer in the UK about what we can do in Liverpool if we get the turnaround facilities.
And Joe Anderson was saying to us last week that he was more confident now because of recent discussions with government ministers. Has there been any update on that, Nick, this week?
I think we're just waiting on some news from the government, but, you know, we remain upbeat that we can get this. We've had some very positive discussions from the government. The government have been very, very pragmatic about this, but, you know, it's around the ambitions that the city have. You know, we will make the market for this. We need to be ambitious about it, and we need to bring, you know, it's going back to our maritime heritage in the city as well.
And again, from a general business point of view, Michael Under can ask you, good morning to you, by the way.
Good morning, Frank.
That's Michael Taylor from Insider Magazine. Liverpool has become a destination tourism city now. You know, we've got an awful lot of investment and, I guess, jobs riding on that, both now and for the future. So cruise liner terminal makes sense for us to invest in, do you think?
It does. I think you made the point in your interview, Frank. It's a growing market. It's also a very segmented market. If Cunard can come here, and the kind of profile that Liverpool's got internationally, I think it's better than Southampton, if I'm honest with you. Yeah? Who's heard of, who comes from Southampton? Apart from Benny Hill.
Mick Shannon, I think. Do you remember him?
I do, yeah. I won't do the arm action. No, Liverpool is an iconic attack brand. I know that might sound like a lot of marketing guff, but I think there's a lot of magnetism to the city, and I think something like this, the gateway to the city, whatever it be, it maritime, as Nick says, or whether it be through planes, trains and automobiles as well, I think all of those are slowly lining up, and the entrance to the city is as great as it's ever been.
Mm. And Natalie, as somebody who owns a business in the city centre, you know, we want to see more people coming here, and we want to see that waterfront packed full with people. We want to see it alive, don't we? So from our perspective, it's absolutely an investment that's worth making.
Oh, definitely. I think the impact it will have on local tourism and visitor-facing businesses will be enormous, really. And as a person that's been on quite a few cruises and quite young as well.
Yeah, but you're 90.
I think the city's got a lot to offer, and in terms of making it more appealing, cruising for certainly younger people, I think Liverpool's an amazingly interesting, gritty, exciting, dynamic place to come for a day trip.
He was actually making the point, I mean, I was tongue-in-cheek, really, as I'm sure you guessed in terms of the way I put the question, but he said, didn't he, that they still do struggle with that image of cruisers being for older people.
Well, like, there's some new operators, just in the way the airline industry's opened up. Apparently in the cruise market, there are businesses like EasyJet that have got into it and offer a slightly different offer.
Yeah.
A mate of mine went on one of these cruises where the guests and the cruisers had more tattoos than the sailors.
And this multi-cation holiday trend, it's obviously, you know, it's people who are wanting to go to more than one location in terms of being away for 10 or 12 days. So you can go to Brazil, to Chile, to Argentina and do the lot on a cruise. And I'm guessing, you know, people now are more fascinated and more prepared to travel. So, yeah, it's an area of business where you can see there is going to be some growth, Nick. Mm.
Absolutely. I mean, it's looking at where those trends are, and I think that came out very, very clear from Cunard around sort of, you know, the more people are going on cruises, it is a more segmented market, and this is going to grow. If we can just come back on the point around sort of the economic impact on Liverpool, and these figures are a few years out of date now, but you know, we found out it was around sort of £75 per head spend that we get at the moment for cruise ships that come in just visiting Liverpool for the day. That increases to almost £200 per head when you get the turnaround facilities, because, you know, people choose to stay a bit longer, people are staying over the night before, they're spending more money in the restaurants, in the hotels. So I think there's a compelling economic case for the city why this should go ahead, and you know, and why we can bring more people into Liverpool, but we can get the spending power of those who come increase significantly.
I think if anything has surprised the business community about Joe Anderson and obviously his team, including yourself, Nick, it's that, you know, we're used to politicians standing up and saying, well, we're going to definitely go for this when we get control of the council. And then they get control and they say, well, we went down to Westminster and actually the Transport Minister said, you ain't got a cat and owl's chance, so sorry, we can't do anything about it. But you just continually argued the case, and it looks as though we might have got there now.
I mean, you know, the thing is, we've got to have private sector led growth in Liverpool, and I think everyone agrees on that. There is no plan B. So, you know, when we say we want to get the cruise liner terminal, when we say that we want to bring investment to Liverpool, we have to do it, because there simply isn't a plan B.
Well, we'll talk about private sector growth and the need for it to drive economic growth in this city, particularly given the fact that the public sector are facing some serious challenges and some serious cuts over the next few years. And of course, there have been public sector strikes this week. We'll be looking at that after the break, along with the Global Entrepreneurs Congress that is coming to the city in March, and also, if we've got time, the Liverpool plan. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this break.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
And welcome back to the show. I'm joined in the studio this week by the Liverpool City Council Cabinet Member Nick Small, Natalie Haywood from Leaf on Bold Street, and the editor of Insider Business Magazine, Michael Taylor. This week, of course, we've seen large-scale strikes from public sector trade unions. We've seen teachers walk out. We've seen other people come out in support of them. Taxmen went on strike for a day, which was great news for some of us in business. Kept them off the phone at least for 24 hours. But it seems that one of the big issues, if not the biggest issue, that is really hitting home to brothers, sisters and comrades in arms is the fact that their pensions are going to be hard hit and they're going to be asked to work additional years. Now, from somebody who's worked in the private sector now for 12 years, someone whose pension has taken a 30% hit over the past 3 years, I'm struggling to have any sympathy with the arguments that are being promoted. I don't know whether you've got that same view as me, Nick, or maybe you've got an alternative view to put to us today.
Well, I think what I'd say is the government are moving much too quickly on that. I think if you look at something like pensions, you know, you can't just take a view 1 year and then a new government comes in a few years' time and takes another view. You've got to have the stability in that, because we are talking about, you know, people's future. We're talking about future earnings for people in retirement, and you need to have that very long-term perspective on that, and the government just don't have that. I think, you know, there's a recognition from all political parties that, you know, things have got to change, but the way the coalition government have gone about this, they've unilaterally taken decisions, they've brought forward changes, and they've not worked in partnership with trade unions, with the employees. And, you know, I think if they did work in partnership, we get a much better deal and much more security and certainty, both for the taxpayer and also for public sector workers.
I have to say, though, listening to some of the language and the narrative coming from trade union leaders, there doesn't seem to be an awful lot of room for manoeuvre in terms of negotiation, does there? I mean, you know, if they were saying, well, yeah, you know, we can understand why people are going to have to work for longer these days, because, you know, just in terms of the fact we're all living longer these days, we simply can't sustain the sort of pension system that we've had over the past 50 years. It is an urgent need of, in my opinion at least, review and restructure. Criticism I would make of the last government is actually they should have done this a lot sooner, and almost they've handed over a mess to the existing government, the coalition government, and they're having to sort it out. And the other thing I'd say to you, Nick, is, you know, this idea of, well, we need years and years to plan what we're going to do. Well, again, you know, I'm not the only one in the private sector that's lost 30% value out of my pension. Some people have done that, and they'll have been 58, 59 and 60, and guess what they've had to do? They've had to say, well, I can't retire when I plan. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to work an extra 2 or 3 years. They haven't taken the bat out and said, well, actually, we're not playing anymore and we want the state to support us.
I think the issue is all about partnership. It's, you know, it's how you bring about these kind of changes, and you have to have that long-term perspective on it, and I don't think this government has done that. That, you know, they've acted unilaterally.
Well, where was the last government's long-term perspective then?
Well, I think, you know, the last government did produce proposals around this. They did go out on consultation. Well, I don't think that's a fair thing to say necessarily, but I think, you know, if you look at some of the changes that have happened with some of the big private sector pension funds, you know, over the last sort of 5 or 6 years, they have happened in partnership, and they've worked closely with the trade unions, with employees, around bringing about this change, because what you need is certainty. And the worst thing that can happen is for the government to bring forward proposals and then for future governments to change those proposals, because what everyone needs here is certainty in retirement. They need to know, you know, that, you know, when they're going to be able to retire, what the quality of life is going to be when they retire, so they can make plans around that. And if governments come in and you know, start making changes unilaterally, don't work together, all the different parties working together, but working in partnership with the employees, then we're not going to get to that position.
Well, you're not convincing me, Nick, but let's see if you've convinced Natalie. What do you think about this big issue over pensions?
Well, I'm so far off retiring, being mid-20s.
You can go off people, you know. You can go off people.
It's kind of gone over my head. I mean, I can't rely on anything except for myself, and that's the way I view everything in life, you know. I earn my own money. I always have done. I'm relying on myself to make my own pension. And so I'm kind of with you, Frank, to be honest, in as much as we've all taken a hit, we've all been through stormy recession waters, and the world's not the same as it was. And because of that, things have to change. And we can talk about long-term plans, but when is it going to happen? You know, like, things need to start moving. And I, you know, I'm with you, I think, on this.
And what about you, Michael?
Yeah, well, at the risk of ganging up here on Nick, I'm with you as well. And what I will say, though, is Nick was making a plea for a dialogue, for some understanding, from some recognition from the government's point of view, with the perspective of the unions that represent people in the public sector. I think and suspect that there probably has been a certain amount of recognition. If one is to drive past the offices of Unison at the on the gateway to the city there, the slogan is quite simple: no cuts. Now, you talk most Labour Party members, officials, and elected politicians will say, yes, you went into the last election on a platform of, well, there needs to be some cuts, but the Tory Lib Dem coalition are doing them too soon. I don't know where you start or where you stop on this one, but I do think there's a recognition that in the public sector and in the private sector, pensions reform has been a hot potato that lots of different governments have all passed along. Mm. It's been too tough to handle, and this government, at least, is grappling it. Mm. And it's probably only a Tory government that could probably do it, because, as Frank said, the Labour government bottled it.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, it's not almost any government that would have been in now, whatever colour, would have had to have tackled this problem because of the fiscal state that we find ourselves in. And, you know, the point that you were making, Nick, in terms of discussion, debate, partnership, I could accept that in terms of the local authority settlement. And I've been very critical in terms of the way the government just said, right, one size fits all, and Liverpool will cut the same as Hampshire and so on and so forth. What I can't sympathise with is trade union leaders going on television night after night saying it's an absolute disgrace that they're going to try and change the pension age. Not this year, next year, but ever. You know, actually, we should only have to work until we're 60 and 65. And anyone with an ounce of common sense these days will tell you that that can't continue. And anyway, mm-hmm. I don't want to retire when I'm 65. Or 70, or 75 for that matter. So, you know, again, there needs to be a recognition that people's thinking about retirement now is often changing. People want to stay active for longer and have an awful lot to put into society as they get older, as they gain experience. Try telling Manchester United fans that Sir Alex Ferguson should be pensioned off. You know, and although there are always going to be exceptions where ill health comes in, or things that we all have to experience and suffer from time to time, I can't for the life of me understand why the public sector and the trade unions who represent them feel that they should be ring-fenced from that reality.
I think, you know, it's about you know, the previous government, previous Labour government, you know, did have proposals to raise the pension age, and what the current government have done has brought that forward, but they haven't done so in a way, you know, that has consulted with public sector workers. And I go back to this point: it is all about partnership. It is, you know, you can't implement the kind of change like this unilaterally. You can't do it overnight. And what's important is that we've got, you know, we have a settlement that everyone can buy into. It's got cross-party support. It's got the support of the trade unions. It's got the support of public sector workers. It's actually got the support of taxpayers, because I think it is, you know, important on this. But this whole debate, you know, there's a lot of inaccuracies in the debate. So if you look, for example, in local government, there's a local government pension fund, but it's actually fully funded. Now, you know, there's other pension funds in the public sector that aren't fully funded. So that means, you know, the current taxpayers are paying for the current pensioners. That isn't the case in local government, and we don't always get the, you know, the nuances of this around. And I think it is a different case in local government.
I think, you know, the issues around pensions are very complex, mm-hmm. and perceptions sometimes don't do any side any favours mm-hmm. in arguments. You know, we're sat here in a city where people watched senior officials walk away from the town hall basically wadded mm-hmm. with cash settlements, and part of that was due to huge pension agreements that they had. Now, whether we like it or not, Nick, and I know, you know, the person who's serving school dinners or the person who's been a lollipop man or lady are not going to be walking away with barrel loads of cash at mm-hmm. the end of their public service. But when you see those senior officials actually having a private and confidential agreement with city leaders, walking away with that sort of cash, and then Liverpool finds itself in the state it is now financially, you can understand why people are sceptical about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that happened a lot under the previous administration in Liverpool, and, you know, it's not happening anymore. We've stopped that from happening. But, you know, there's the other point around this is around, you know, pensioner poverty, and around, you know, pensions are deferred earnings, and as long as you've got, you know, a gap and people earn different amounts of money, you're going to have people who are retiring on a lot more and some who are retiring on a lot less. Mm. We also need to look at those on the bottom. And I think if you look at the average public sector pension, you know, it's a lot less than people need to live on. So I think sort of any deal that's done around pensions, we need to have the lowest paid at the very heart of that and make sure that they get a fair deal. And I'm not convinced that that will happen with this government. Mm.
Michael, what's your sense of the private sector's view of this whole row? And in fact, the general view out there, do you think the government's actually a win in this particular debate?
I think the government are winning the argument. I think there's a massive groundswell of sympathy for them on this one. I think there's a great fault line in British society that's been opened up a little bit by this, by the disputes that happened last Thursday. I think it's really exposed that difference between people who work in the public sector and private sector. I'm glad, by the way, Nick, that we've not resorted in this debate to talk about, well, on one hand you've got the dinner ladies and on the other, and the brave bobbies on the beat and the angels, the nurses, and on the other hand you've got the fat cat bankers. Because a lot of people who work in the private sector, particularly in the north of England, earn diddly squat. And that's a massive, massive danger to the economy. People on low wages, people teetering on the brink, people sweating over a gas bill and whether they can pay it. That's the daily reality of most people in this country, and that's why I think the teachers in this case haven't got a great deal of sympathy.
And we're talking about private sector pay and people coming out of public sector jobs into the private sector, because we've been told that, you know, it's the private sector that needs to start to soak some of these jobs up. And as you referred earlier, Nick, you know, we've got to be seen as a city that is driven by its private sector and business community. But again, Natalie, I don't know about you, but we've been having conversations with, we've been recruiting staff. We're in a fortunate position that we're able to do that. But it's an interesting conversation when you're talking to someone who's come out of the public sector in terms of holidays, benefits and pensions. I don't know if you've experienced that at all, or whether you've recruited from purely people with private sector background.
I tend to go for people with private sector background, people that are very entrepreneurial in thought and spirit and are quite creative. And very young people as well, actually. I'm the oldest person in my business, so everyone around me is very young and forward-thinking. Not that there's, you know, older people aren't, but I tend to go for very young, just fresh out of university, people that I can mould. But the people I live with, someone who works, you know, in the public sector, and she seems to be a little bit disillusioned and feels that everything should be given to her on a plate, and that annoys me a little bit. Whereas we're you know, we've been through so many hard times over the last couple of years that I'm grateful for every penny that's in my till.
Yeah.
I'm grateful that I'm still going.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a bit of a reality check. And again, you know, people use this great term, deficit denier. And I don't think we have got, you know, within the leadership of the City Council or indeed the Labour Party nationally, that sort of deficit denial. But I do wonder about some of our trade union colleagues. Anyway, let's try and get onto a subject that we can be more positive about and agree upon. Because next March, the Kaufman Foundation are going to bring the Global Entrepreneurs Congress to Liverpool. It's going to be a fantastic series of events looking at how we can drive forward enterprise. And the city had to bid against some firm competition to actually win this, as I say, superb event. Natalie, you spoke at an event last Wednesday for downtown Liverpool during our business week, where we had Jonathan Ortmans from the Kaufman Foundation on the panel alongside Steve Morgan, Max Steinberg and Jeb Fitzgerald. This is something that, as a young entrepreneur, excites you, the fact that Liverpool can attract this great event?
Oh, I think it's absolutely amazing for the city. It's such a great opportunity and it's really going to put us on the map in terms of, you know, being entrepreneurial and in spirit and thought, and, you know, give businesses a real platform to make something happen and to raise profile and everything else. And I thought that everything he had to say and the reasons why he brought it to Liverpool were all really great and positive. And I think, are we the first European...
Yes, first city in Europe.
European city to get it. So I think it's going to do enormous things for the city.
Nick, I know you were one of the people who worked really hard to get this Congress into Liverpool.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've been quite sort of enterprising around how we did this. It's quite an interesting story. A guy called Chris Arnold, who runs a business called Smaller Earth, and he was involved in the Your Big Year event last year.
Yeah.
He brought this to me. It was around the end of December. It was actually the last meeting I had before Christmas. I went into Liverpool Vision and he said, look, I think this is really good, let's look at doing it. And myself and Mike Taylor from Vision were out in Washington in mid-January pitching this to Kaufman. They said, look, you know, come, really impressed by it, come and put a formal bid in, which we did. And you know, we brought it to the city, but we beat Copenhagen, we beat Abu Dhabi, we beat Santiago in Chile, I think two other European cities who Kaufman won't tell us about. So it's massive in terms of what this can bring to the city. But I think it shows, you know, what can happen when, you know, we see some of these opportunities. And what we were talking around before, around sort of the public and private sector, this is a great example of, you know, having the public sector working with the private sector, you know, and trying to do something that will promote private sector growth. There's a compelling reason why we need this in Liverpool, and we need to improve that. We need to increase the number of businesses we've got. Yeah. There was a report that's come out of from Biz recently, looking at all the different LEP areas, and they look around sort of how many active businesses there are per 1,000 residents in the Enterprise M3 LEP, which covers part of Surrey and Hampshire. There's 52 businesses for every 1,000 residents. In Liverpool, there's only 26. So, you know, we need to double the amount of businesses that we've got. In Manchester, there's 34. We need to up our game on that. And I think, you know, what Kaufman is saying around sort of future economic growth, it will happen, you know, with small start-up new businesses. They're going to be the wealth creators of the future. They're going to create the jobs. They're going to create the investment. They're going to do all the innovation. Mm. And it's those businesses we need to get in there and support.
Yeah, it's a great point. But Michael, Liverpool was built by entrepreneurs, very entrepreneurial city, but perhaps lost its way a little. And this image, certainly image, if not necessarily reality, is that there's too many of us who are looking for a handout rather than a hand up. And, you know, this sort of conference is aimed at trying to recreate that entrepreneurial spirit that the city is famous for. Do you think Liverpool has started to get there? Because you deal, as I say, regionally with the private sector. Is Liverpool now a pond that's worth fishing in for guys who are looking for businesses, who want to market, promote and get their message out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Liverpool's very much got the message. I think the fact that Liverpool One got built before the credit crunch was a massive fillip for the city. Mm. It brought the city into the mainstream of the British economy. I think there has been consistently in the last 10 years many initiatives and many opportunities to promote an entrepreneurial culture and a private sector-led emergence from this imbalance between the public sector that Nick's statistics bore up. And I think global entrepreneurs congresses coming to Liverpool is a good thing. It can only be a good thing. I'd like to be contrary and say, what are these Yanks know about Liverpool coming over here telling us to run a business? That would just be controversial for its own sake. Because there are also lots of economic spin-offs. Mm. And I also think it's important for Liverpool to position itself, to come back to the tourism argument, as somewhere, as a great place for conferences, exhibitions. Mm. Yeah, I mean, in various industries in the past, I've been to cities like Amsterdam and Las Vegas, Geneva, Hanover, for computer exhibitions and stuff like that. And I think Liverpool needs to position itself there because it's got so much else to offer.
Yeah, and Jonathan Ortmans was actually saying, you know, although he'd obviously a vision of Liverpool as a vibrant, dynamic place, really was surprised, I think, by how modern the city now was. And he was fascinated by the way in which we'd redeveloped and regenerated the city centre. Was absolutely wowed by the Hilton Hotel where we had the event. I think they've booked it out now for March.
No, and I think Liverpool's actually one of the I don't know the reasons, Nick, honestly, about why this event's coming to Liverpool, but I think there's a message here of social entrepreneurship and how that can then retranslate back into the global economy, how people can use their entrepreneurial skills for the betterment of society. Because I think it's unquestionable that the role of the state in trying to solve every problem. In every Western society, I think there's a recognition that the state has got too bloated and needs to shrink. And maybe actually within some of the third sector and the social enterprises in Liverpool, there's a useful message to actually bring back to the rest of the global economy. To other cities that might want to come here and listen to what Liverpool has to offer as well. I think a lot of people, there's always a danger that you can talk down the north of England at the moment. And I think, you know, maybe there are actually some great brands, some great ways of doing business, some great traders and some great legacy born out of what we have here.
And can I just drill into something that Altman said last week and Natalie probably touched on without necessarily realising earlier? He said that they've done a study over the past 3 years in the States whereby they now know that newer businesses are the job creators. And the one thing that we didn't quite get round to discussing was why that might be the case, because it obviously limited time and so on and so forth. But I guess one of the reasons is that younger businesses are more flexible, more nimble. If you've been around the last 3 or 4 years, then you certainly know how to handle crises because nothing has stayed the same. And for someone like you, because your story's interesting in that you were in one business and you've switched to another because you've seen a better opportunity, do you think that there's almost a generational thing that younger entrepreneurs actually do see the need to change and they'll do it quicker?
I definitely do. I think that's a really valid point. I think I've certainly done that. A lot of my peers and people that I mix with, entrepreneurs who are in my kind of group, do the same. I think we've had to the last 3 years, but you know, you've had to survive, really. But I think Jonathan was saying as well that the growth in businesses in the first 5 years is where the biggest growth happens, wasn't he? And it's the younger businesses within those first year to 5 years is where all the jobs get created and where the growth and the turnover comes. And I'd say definitely. I think there's also this feeling now of, you know, so much has gone wrong. It's kind of now or never, and people are really getting the bit between their teeth and going for it. Whereas in the past, it might have been a bit more like, you know, I'll start a business and we'll plod along. And I think people now are like, I'm just going to go for this. And
do you think, because again, this discussion we were sort of having after the event last week, that younger businesses are also more likely to collaborate and form strategic alliances? Because I'm certainly aware now of more and more businesses partnering with who previously may have been seen as competitors or potential competitors, where now it's like, well, I'd rather have 50% of something than 100% of nothing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of clustering happening between small businesses and people aligning themselves maybe geographically or aligning themselves with like-minded people. Absolutely, definitely. We've certainly done that. My business, Leaf, at the moment is kind of one of our biggest selling points, I think, is that we're so well networked within the creative industries and with like-minded businesses and influencers and people within the city that we all kind of top each other up, you know, pass things around. And certainly there's clustering, I would say so, in Liverpool.
And Michael, Insider have been running this thing for years, which I think is absolutely super initiative, called 42 Under 42, where you identify the up-and-coming entrepreneurs. I don't know how I failed to get into that list. I obviously came into the private sector a little bit too late. But nonetheless, if you look at some of the names over the past 12 months, never mind beyond that, there are some great people coming through, aren't there?
Oh, all the time. And what always fascinates me is people explain the basis of their business. Oh, we do, we organise medical reports for people who've had accidents on behalf of insurers and lawyers. And you think, well, who on earth thought of that idea to insert themselves into it? That was the last person I happened to have interviewed, you know. These niche businesses, I mean, the world is changing so quickly. I've never known a time like it, and it's probably the slowest time that we're going to appreciate with this tsunami of technology that's coming crashing down on us all the time. I think it's fascinating. Look at a business with a valuation of in the billions, like Groupon, which is a coupons business. Didn't even exist 2 years ago, and yet it's got traction so quickly.
I think there's two big things that come through around sort of new businesses. One is innovation and that sort of capacity to embrace change and to go with that. And the other is this sort of different view of failure. I think, you know, if you look at, you know, many businesses will fail. I think the way that we've looked at business failure in the UK in the past, it's always been, you know, the banks will pour money into businesses right till the very end, and then, you know, you go bankrupt and that's it. Actually, you know, what new businesses are doing is people will, you know, do things for 6 months or a year or 2 years. It's maybe not working out. They'll refocus or they'll do something else. They'll set something else up, and it's a sort of different idea. You know, if you've never failed, you've never innovated. You know, you've not been an innovator, and I think, you know, that comes out really well. The big thing I think that we get with new businesses and what we want to get from Global Entrepreneurship Congress is looking at some of those groups where traditionally they people haven't set up businesses. So with young people, with women, with people from black and minority ethnic communities, people living in inner cities, you know, there's real scope there to get people from those groups setting up businesses where they haven't done in the past. And I think that's where there's a big opportunity for growth in places like Liverpool.
Michael? There is, and a lot of these also can perform some of the social functions that the state might have to be withdrawn from. Yeah. I'm sorry to bang the same drum once again. Frank, you mentioned that my magazine do something called the 42 Under 42, which is for business people who are either tipping for success or have made their mark at a young age. I was also involved in something very recently called Young Enterprise, where that was school kids. And at first I thought, well, it's going to be school kids pitching an idea. It wasn't. It was school kids who have run a business while they're doing their exams, while they're in old money. It was the fifth year. It is fabulous. And I'll tell you what, I had to fight back the tears of pride.
Yeah.
There were these kids and they were presenting their ideas. Well, not their ideas, their businesses that they had run, that they had made in some instances thousands of pounds by, you know, putting hampers together, putting together a disc to protect kids in schools. They're from all points of the Northwest. And it was fabulous. And the best thing about it was loads better than any idiot that you've seen on The Apprentice.
Oh my gosh, you take the words out of my mouth.
And it was a load better as well than half of the Muppets who've gone up the stairs to pitch to the Dragon's Den.
Absolutely, couldn't agree with you.
So there was no humiliation either. Yeah. It was absolutely terrific. And if that gave me a lot of faith, that actually there's a great culture and of role models and wanting to make some money for themselves, but also that they've got business skills.
Well, Steve Morgan was actually referring to his first business deal, which was he bought some Conkers for sixpence and then sold them on at a profit in school. And Natalie, you were doing similar things when you were at school, weren't you? Not necessarily
selling,
with Conkers.
Trolls and big rubbers out of my blazer pocket, I think, when I was about seven. Until I got told off.
So entrepreneurs start at an early age.
Definitely.
One of the things we're trying to do, we're launching sort of a thing with schools in the run-up to Global Entrepreneurship Congress. So we're looking at giving some seed capital to, I think it's going to be to all schools in Liverpool, and rolling that out, seeing who can make money, seeing who can do a business idea, and sort of bringing that in as part of the part of the Congress.
Brilliant.
Because if we get out there in the schools, that's where, you know, you've got the hearts and minds of the young people, and you know, the entrepreneurs are going to come
if the teachers aren't on strike, Nick. One thing to add on that. I've looked in the last week at some fabulous new workspaces, including the BBC's new home at Media City, if that's all right to mention it on this radio station. But what I will say is classrooms have always looked the same. They're still the same as they were in the Victorian times, and probably even before that, when kids used to sit around a cave and listen to the chief of the tribe telling them the facts of life. And yet workplaces have completely changed. I think there's a big challenge.
There's a big challenge. I mean, some of that we're already addressing with the building schools for the future, with some of the transformational education. That's all changed. Schools look totally different from when I was there. And
We'll ask P. Price about what schools, classrooms look like in the dark ages. Jonathan will do that on the show during the week. But I'm afraid we've run out of time. And that's it from me, Frank McKenna, City Talks Business, for another Sunday. Thanks to my guests, Natalie Haywood, Nick Small and Michael Taylor. Thanks to Jonathan Dean, my producer. Most of all, thank you for listening. Have a great week, and don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. Listen and log on to great music and great conversation on City Talk 105.9.